we'll just pick up at your responses.
I thought it was awesome. It was about time to be reminded of our purpose.
Well, that's why I said it.
You didn't pull any punches. And yet it was said so gently.
I'm wondering, I don't know if there's anybody here that didn't like this. That has questions.
They're in the room here.
But because I know there are people that didn't and responded very negatively and very strongly to it.
Really?
Yeah.
What were some of the comments you heard?
You just don't understand the liberal churches, liberal bashing.
I heard a comment that it was demonizing people rather than their sins.
Now I'm going to try to think of some other things. But what I'm wondering is how, because I like what you said, and I found it, I would say, convicting and encouraging and filled with hope. And I have to admit that, it brings me to tears. But there are people that, just couldn't deal with it. How can we, in love, respond and talk to those who just so didn't like it and responded so negatively? And I mean, these couple examples are the only things right now that I can think of passing on. But part of that is, what can we do if we believe and want to affirm? How can we respond
Well, I do think that we have to appreciate the fact that there's no screening of people who come to the conference, and therefore we send out the call, and people come, and they are in various stages of development, maybe not even of development, but at least at certain stages, and maybe they have basically squatted on a particular place, out of indeed unresolved problems, So there can be a great deal of continuing resentment, for example, against their church experience and background and so forth. And so they hear my critiquing of a liberal point of view as critiquing the very sources of their support these days, because they don't know that there are people who are staunchly evangelical who will also be supportive of them and so forth. But I do think that response is the response of unrequited love. They want to be accepted by the evangelical world. They wouldn't have any other reason to be here, because they could go to any number of gay conferences and even gay/religion conferences and hear the exact opposite message, you see. So they know, at least with me, they're going to hear this when they come, unless they're just absolutely first-timers. So, and I should think that a lot of the first-timers would be more amenable to what I said than others who have sort of, as they say, sort of squatted in their militancy and in their unresolved anger toward the church. So, there is a sense in which there's nothing you can do. You can just set up the flag and see who salutes and who doesn't and so forth. And there'll be some people who, because of where they have been and the hurt that they have endured and continue to endure, that they that they're just going to continue to be angry, you know, and they're not getting, you know, good psychotherapy, and so that's where they are, and there's nothing really you can do about it. You pray for them and be, you know, loving toward them, but being loving is not to, you know, pull punches on a an ideological critique. You see, I think the people who think that I was attacking people instead of ideas are, you know, they have a jaundiced look at it. I noticed, for example, last night when Alex was speaking, and part of his illustrative background there was, you know, the 700 Club, and as soon as Robertson's picture came up on the screen, there was a certain amount of hissing. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that certainly is about an individual rather than, you know, ideas. So I think that we always have to be open to the free marketplace of ideas and so forth, you know. But as I say, this is the only gay and Christian event, really, of this magnitude, where they're going to hear what they heard today. Every place else is not, and so they could go to all of these places. So, from my point of view, it's not the purpose of EC to tailor ourselves to be pleasing to those people. To be loving, yes, but not to be pleasing to them. And I don't know if you think that makes any sense, but that's my point of view.
So, I'm not sure where to begin on my on this stick. Both last night's presentation and yours, for me, were the kind of schizophrenic experience, where I had one moment going, yes, yes, and the next moment I'm going, oh, no, that's ridiculous. And sometimes it was the same sentence that I'd say that too.
Could you give me an example of, from my...
Boy, I wish I got here. let me just read a little bit more, and then I can ask some questions I think that might be useful. Now, there's no question that that there's a lot going on for me. There's a lot of work, and some of it's pretty hard work. And but I also increasingly found myself very frustrated with evangelicalism, and I'm not sure that I know what that means. And I guess maybe that's one of the questions I would ask, but. I found that without a lot of changes in my theology, I'm a lot more comfortable someplace else. But I've also sort of figured out that without a lot of changes in my theology, I actually really don't, or maybe without regard to anything else I've said, I actually want to be left alone in church. I really don't want to get into what goes on in church, because what's going on in church for me is between me and God, and that's an extremely important thing right now, but that isolated piece. But I think, I guess if I were going to ask a question, when you talk about evangelicalism, are you making a statement about Orthodox theology, or are you talking about the First Southern Baptist Church or whatever down on the corner? Or are you talking about Pat Robertson, or are you talking about folks in the family, or what is it I think about? What is it I should think
about? Well, a number of years ago, I have begun to use a term, and I used it today in the talk. It may have gone by, you know, too quickly for you to see it. But
everything went by too quickly.
What?
I said everything went by too quickly.
Okay.
Hey, there's a lot.
But, and again, I think, you know, people either who are agreeing or disagreeing with what I'm saying have to put today's talk in the context of what they know about me over the years, you know. I mean, you know, that sort of a thing. And quite frankly, I realize a lot of people don't realize that. You know, they've just been around for 2 or 3 years in E.C. and, you know, there's Ralph Blair and stuff like that. Almost a decade before Stonewall, as an evangelical, I was preaching the integration of homosexuality and Christian faith, you know, and got, you know, kicked out of the university staff for it, and so forth. So, I mean, I've been around the block, and people have to, you know, have to have at least some sense that, you know, I'm not, you know, some Johnny come lately on, you know, rah-rah for evangelical land. And that's the word that I've been using. You know, evangelical land is a cultural artifact. And we need not defend evangelical land. I think to a great extent what I call evangelical land is this, is the social milieu of American evangelicalism has co-opted, has been co-opted to a great extent by a right-wing political agenda. In the same way that more mainline churches have been co-opted by the left-wing political agenda, and neither is the church, or neither, you know, neither is the, is the gospel. By evangelical, I simply mean the euangelion, the good news in the New Testament, that God was in Christ reconciling the world to Himself. Now, it may be surprising to you, but a great deal of the mainline church really does not subscribe to that. And certainly, I would say the bulk of the gay-affirming religious organizations are not particularly interested in that. So, when I say evangelical, I mean, you know, I intended EC to be a seriously Christian organization that happens to be comprised of gay people, gay, lesbian, whatever. Simply because, and we meet together because we're not welcome in a lot of other, venues, where, because of ignorance and so forth, the evangelicals there, people for whom the fact that God was in Christ reconciling the world to Himself is important, as it is to us, but they're just behind the times in terms of being, of understanding what in the world is homosexuality and so forth. And so out of, you know, innocent ignorance, as well as, and I think that's where most of them are. I mean, some leaders are willfully ignorant because they'll lose their jobs if they come around, you know, that's what. So I just want a place for people who are seriously evangelical, that is, the gospel, that God was in Christ reconciling the world to Himself, to come and become more and more serious Christians, and so forth. And obviously, there's all kinds of church politics, but there are church politics in the Unitarian Church, you know, and right now, the biggest controversy in their history is the controversy over the use of the word God. You know, plenty of Unitarians don't want to use the word God in any of their literature or meetings and so forth, and the new president is sort of urging, well, maybe once in a while we can use the word God. You know?
Is that linguistic?
Well, no. It's not, but I'm just saying, but there you see, if you're that even non-theist, then of course, and you're politically liberal, then of course you can endorse the agenda of the ACLU and say we're a gay-affirming church, or really they don't even call themselves church so much as, you know, religious affiliation, religious association. You know, and the same way is true for the Bishop Spongs and Sprogs of the world, you know. I mean, I'm not attacking them personally when I use their name as a touchstone for a whole approach. You know, the resurrection didn't happen, Jesus was, taken down from the cross and eaten by dogs, you know. I mean, that's the point of view of the basically the Jesus seminar, and, you know, people like that. Well, I mean, if that is what Christian faith is, why bother to get up on Sunday morning to go to church? Or why, you know, why even have a connection or, you know, so forth? So I think that it is true, as you say, that a lot of people have made the mistake of confusing the evangel, or the good news, with what I call evangelical land, and that's just the, you know, the social and cultural takeover of certain churches. And there's no reason to defend that. In fact, there's every reason to attack that. But having said that, it still remains that you know, that we have God's revelation in Scripture, and we have 2,000 years of brighter minds than ours wrestling with these theological issues, and working things through in a way that is a great deal that all Christians hold in common, and that's essential. I mean, you know, all essentially biblical or Orthodox Christians hold together, you know, and they are in Catholic Church, and they are in mainline churches, and you know, and so forth. And that's I mean, it's in the truest sense of an ecumenical concern. I'm just, you know, basically holding to that. It's why. And some people have mentioned this to me, you know, when I talk, this year it was a great deal more about gayness, you know, but in some years I don't talk about gayness much at all in the keynotes, and when I invite keynoters, I say, you know, talk about Christian discipleship, or whatever it is that you feel, you know, is something that you can particularly handle well. You don't have to talk about homosexuality in the keynotes, you know, because this is a Christian conference for Christians about Christian discipleship, So that's the way I see it, and if people don't like it, well, as I say, there are many other organizations that they can go to.
I have, my parents were raised Mennonite, mm-hmm. and raised in a GARBC church, mm-hmm. And the national secretary of that congregation, when he found out I was going to Wheaton College, predicted that I would leave the GARBC, and my parents would too, and he was correct.
What is the GARBC?
That's a
General Association of Regular Baptists. It's a very fundamentalist.
Yeah, it's a small fundamentalist, hyper-fundamentalist. Well, not mm-hmm. really, but it's certainly very much on the right side. Mm-hmm. It was a reactionary split from the conservative Baptists, which they didn't feel went far enough.
Yeah. It's
basically where it came from.
And it is, as you say, a reactionary group.
Right.
As is the whole of fundamentalism. I mean, an evangelical is not a fundamentalist. And so to go off to Wheaton, you would be exposed to stuff that is obviously going to redirect your path from that kind of separatist fundamentalist mentality, which is very well worth leaving, because it only arose in the 20s, you know, 1920s. The evangelical faith is 20 centuries old. Mm-hmm. So,
and my personal career then found me moving into first the American Baptist and then Presbyterian Church, and both in first in Berkeley, with Earl Palmer, who I probably know, mm-hmm. and then when I was at the Navigators, mm-hmm. with in a large Presbyterian church there in Colorado Springs, and I'm probably exhausted. Is one of the things that's going on for sure, but. Back in San Francisco now, I'm going to the neighborhood Episcopal Church, and I went there because I decided that my Christianity is about my relationship with God, and it's not about anything else, and that needs to be the place of focus, and that there's an element of God
that I can't access, or there's... The mystery of God is not accessible in an objective kind of environment. And I really need a place where it is possible to relate to God in a much more subjective kind of a way. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking for an environment where it was maybe structured, but at the same time had a lot of freedom for me to be in relationship with God. Mm-hmm. And I was very surprised, that was the reason I went there. I was very surprised to find that I was very comfortable with the kinds of things that were said and things were done by the teaching, basically. There are things that I'm probably not as comfortable with, but I wasn't mm-hmm. comfortable with things that I heard from the pulpit and most of the churches mm-hmm. I've been in. So I don't find myself overly challenged to accommodate, and in fact most of my theological shifts have taken place actually while I was at the Navigators. So that was driven strongly by a question from an Abrev who said, you know, what's the threshold of belief? And by the time I got done answering that question, it turned out I thought about the world a little bit differently and the nature of my relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
So where am I going? How did I start that? One of the problems is Alzheimer's beginning to take over. I think it's a sign of distress. But, I don't know if you've seen the newest edition of Christianity Today. I got it last week. And it's got an article there about a movement to infiltrate by the evangelical church, to infiltrate the mainline churches in Southern Rite. And in the middle of it is, as an anchoring point for how they will be effective, is the fact that the gay issue is such a hot issue. And this is written by a couple of sociologists. And I read this, and my reaction was, first of all, the entire magazine has suddenly become very shrill. It's got an edge to it that is disquieting. And this is so many backgrounds, supposedly. The other thing that I noticed is that, Christianity Today and I have had a sort of a deep relationship for the last 10 or 15 years, when I've at times felt very comfortable reading it, other times I've been really frustrated by things going there. But I noticed that I don't know anybody in the magazine anymore, and I should know those people.
You mean people who are writing or talking, being talked about and so on?
Mm-hmm. And I'm beginning to wonder, I guess I'm just trying to figure out whether, one of the exercises that we were asked to do was to list some things for the weekend. And I decided that, the first thing I put down was before the weekend is over, I need to figure out whether I should rescind the conclusion that I've come to that I'm no longer willing to claim to be evangelical. And that's really where I am. I don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I was saying earlier, you know, don't think you have to, in order to be an evangelical, rubber stamp, even popular notions in evangelical land. Because
part of the problem is those people are so visible.
Well, but I think there's another side to that story. Quite apart from the fact that I think that the evangel is, at least at this point in history, really alive, you know, only, you know, or most clearly in that area, even with an awful lot of garbage, which, as some of you know, they used to refer to the GIRB as the Garbage Baptist.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
And I know why.
Well, yes, of course. And there's plenty of garbage in evangelical land, you know. But there was plenty of garbage in the first church, you know. There was plenty of garbage among the disciples who spent 3 years with Jesus. So I think that one of the things that maybe we can, you know, kind of heal ourselves about is the expectation that anyone in the evangelical world, or for that matter outside of the evangelical world, is anything other than a sinner and a self-obsessed sinner and in need of salvation by grace. Now, I don't hear that preached anyplace except within the evangelical church. I mean, many churches have even given up the prayer of confession, thinking, you know, it's a downer, and that, you know, that's good. And yet it's the only thing that works. So I do think that it's certainly totally understandable why plenty of people at this conference, including you, have been burned and burned out by a lot of self-centered, you know, people, leaders, ignorance, innocent ignorance as well as willed ignorance and so forth. So there's a lot of pathology there, but there's pathology throughout every system and in every church and so forth. And there's politics in every organization, no matter whether it's a left wing or right wing or, you know, whatever. So I think that we have to be careful that we don't unnecessarily discourage ourselves by seeing that people in our organization or in the, you know, evangelical world or wherever have clay feet and, you know, that sort of thing. But to kind of have a sense of, well, what is the best mixed bag that's there? And I think it's, as I say, understandable why burned out and just burned, one would want to retreat and, you know, as you put it, just, you know, the relationship between you and God. But I do think that from a New Testament point of view, there needs to be the body of believers, and that is, in fact, the body of Christ and so forth. And it doesn't mean that we have to find the pure church or the that's everything. Just where they're very nice people or, you know, so forth. I mean, as a matter of fact, one of the ways in which we grow in grace is to have to deal with others who, like ourselves, are not so easy to deal with all the time, you know. But that is a strengthening thing if we know how to deal with it prayerfully and lovingly and so forth. I think another thing that I'd caution you about is to be careful about searching for that place where you're comfortable. Because, you know, I mean, I understand what they mean when they say here a lot of times, this is a safe place and you're safe and so forth. And that needs to be said within a certain context. Because a lot of people have been bashed and damaged and abused and so on. But when we put the premium on safety, we have to understand that is not the call in the New Testament. It is not to safety. It is the way of the cross, which was an execution instrument, you know, in the first century. So, and Jesus said, look, you know, people are going to hate you for my sake. Don't have people hate you because you're such a, you know, obnoxious individual. But have people hate you, as Jesus said? They would. They hated him, they'll hate you, you know. And so I think that we do have to be careful about looking for a place where we're comfortable. As I say sometimes to my psychotherapy patients, you know, we can say, well, I never thought of it that way, or I never heard that, or, you know, I don't agree with that. I said, that's great. If you never heard of it, or you don't agree. Because if everything I say to you already brought into the room here with you, then I'd be redundant. You shouldn't be here, you see? And the same way with our Christian discipleship and so forth. Rather than look for a church where, you know, basically, you know, there's more here that I can agree with or more comfortable, you know, say, regardless of whether it's comfortable, are they preaching the word? And the word preached, you know, one can know is uncomfortable. You know, when one hears we're supposed to love our enemies, and we know we don't love our enemies. So if that is being preached, we're not going to be so uncomfortable. You know, that's be comfortable. Whereas if what is being preached is, as in the fundamentalist and even evangelical land, mega churches, those terrible gays, they're ruining our marriage and, you know, and so forth. Well, that's certainly not loving enemies as they perceive their enemies, but everybody is rah, rah, yeah, yeah, you know. And then you go to a gay congregation and the enemy is George Bush or Robert Robertson, or, you know, something. So yeah, you know, hiss, and so forth. Well, the people in both congregations are quite comfortable, and the people in both congregations are quite wrong. So anyway, that's a long response to that.
So you think the conflict that sometimes we have when we're locking horns here is not such a bad thing?
It's not such a bad thing. I think
sometimes it's been pretty painful.
Oh, well,
especially when you come expecting that it's evangelical in nature, then someone says, well, you can't say a prayer like this anymore. And to me, that's not inclusive at all.
But that's not a give and take. That is, you know, sort of ruling out these sort of things. But then you have to ask, well, you know, then how come you're here? And of course, I don't know, it would seem to me, that as painful as it is for some people to be there who didn't like what I said, if they keep coming back, then it would seem to me that that says that they have not resolved this unrequited love that is there, you see. So the more hostile they are, the more they're wrestling. You know, you don't hurt your feelings if the taxi driver insults you, because the taxi driver is a stranger. You hurt your feelings when somebody that you care about says something nasty to you, or disagrees with you, or doesn't coddle you, or, you know, whatever. And you're upset about it. They wouldn't be upset if they didn't give a damn. You see? In either direction, no matter what was left, right, whatever. We're upset because, you know, we need to be a certain way relationship with the church, you know, and we have a sense the church is demanding something impossible from us, you know, like not to be gay. Well, then obviously that's very frustrating. And when we're feeling frustrated, the way we handle frustration, no matter if we're on the left or right, we feel frustrated, we're going to get angry. Because when we get hostile, it seems like we're in charge. But it doesn't seem like we're in charge when we're frustrated or when we're hurt, you see? And so it's normal to expect people to be hostile when they are feeling hurt or frustrated or anxious. You know, some people think, yes, it maybe even is true that gay people are going to, you know, go to hell. And that's anxiety producing, you see? But simply because they say, oh no, that's a bunch of bullshit, you see, that doesn't mean that they believe it. You know? Cynicism, for example. You find people sort of throwing out the baby with the bath and, you know, being cynical about religion and everything. Well, that doesn't mean that they truly buy into what they're saying in their cynicism. Cynicism, if you really take a look at it psychologically, is basically an expression of the idea, I wish to God that it were so, and I am so afraid and disillusioned that it ain't. So you know, I mean, we'd ask even you, you know, how come you still subscribe to CT? You know, that, you know, that's it.
Well, my mother subscribed to it for me. This
oh,
time.
For you, okay. But listen, I'll tell you.
I'll tell you.
I'll tell you, there are more and more evangelical leaders who are supportive of what we're doing. More and more. When I started EC, I wondered, how am I ever going to find even, you know, more than a handful of evangelical leaders who would speak at conferences and so forth. And now, really, there are more than I can use, because I never repeat the same person. And for 53 conferences, I've never repeated the same keynote speaker, except, you know, to have them maybe in the East and then also in the West, or Midwest. It's just one person I've repeated.
You.
Moi. I've never turned myself down. Every indication. But, I mean, so that's a lot of people. And these have been major leaders in the evangelical world. Nicholas Woltersdorf and Lou Smeads and Rosalind Rinker and Charlie Shedd. And, you know, I mean, big people. You contrast that with, for example, the Exodus conferences. Now, they get a lot more people at their conferences because, you know, they get a lot of anti-gay preachers there and parents that are going crazy and, you know, that's... But who are their keynoters? Their keynoters are more and more simply, you know, Joe Blow at Tampa, head of the gay, ex-gay, you know, the ex-gay ministry in Tampa, or head of the ex-gay group in St. Paul, Minnesota, whatever. It's like, and that should tell us something. How come they're not getting the biggies in the evangelical world? Because I think an awful lot of the biggies in the evangelical world really know where the thing lies.
Well, see, part of the problem I'm having is that I'm beginning to suspect that there is no substance of faith in some parts of evangelicalism.
Oh, I'm sure that you're right. Just as there's
and
no
that's
substance.
The reason I think that CT also sounded shrill. I mean, I disagree with them a lot.
But there are people connected with CT. There's a. I can't tell you too much. There's a biggie in CT that told me he'd be delighted to be a keynoter next year when I asked him to be a keynoter. And he wants to check it out with his wife's schedule. She's also a, you know, very active leader. And Philip Yancey is still editor at large at CT, and he has a blurb on Mary Lou's book. First person on there, the blurb. So, and he's been a friend for a long time. I've been very involved with the Ravi Zacharias ministry, and he was a speaker one year at the Founders Weekend for basically the main supporters of that ministry every fall. And you know, so over the years we've, you know, been very friendly and he's supportive. I mean, there are plenty of people who are supportive of us quietly and, you know, to the extent that they can. And many of them can't do it more because then their credibility would be shot. But nonetheless, many have been keynoters for us.
It's the way of the cross.
Yeah. Well. Yes. But I mean, there's such a thing as being.
I have to carry it.
There's such a thing as you know, being disciplined and then being foolish. You know. So I mean, you have to protect your ministry, you know, that's how you but there are plenty of evangelical leaders who have gone out on a limb for us, and you know, many of them are heterosexual. So how come they went out on a limb for us? We, being gay, could do no other than go out on a limb in a sense. You know, we had to, you know, work it back through. We had a vested interest. But people like Nick Woltersdorf and Lou Smeads and you know, some of these other people, they didn't have to get involved with this. You know? So, And we send out Record and Review to 2,000 people, and, you know, we send it to individuals, but we also send it to institutions. And you'd be surprised the number of evangelical institutions who will write me and say they're missing, you know, in their library, they're missing certain issues. Could I please, you know, resupply them with it and so forth. So they're not trying to hold the literature back from their student body or their, you know, whatever. And these are Southern Baptist seminaries and Assemblies of God colleges and, you know, and so forth. So don't give up on, you know, some of the people within the evangelical world that are working behind the scenes and they're working out in front. And they have the, and they have in the gospel the message of life, which is not found where that gospel is denied and where that you know, where the prayer of confession is a downer, and, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, there was a preaching in a couple of weeks. It's on the very birthday of the woman who wrote "Jesus Loves Me, This I Know," Anna Bartlett Warner. And the last Sunday in August at City Church, and I'm pointing out, you know, well, Jesus loves you, but you have to really know, well, which Jesus loves you? You know, does the Jesus of Ralph Waldo Emerson love you? I mean, you know, or the Jesus of the Jesus Seminar who was eaten by dogs, does he love you? I mean, that's the present tense, you know. You're saying Jesus loves you because he's alive. But if you don't believe in the resurrection, then how can he love you, you know? As I'm going to point out, you know, people are saying, Moses loves you. Moses loves me, this I know, you know. Because Moses doesn't, never heard of you, you know. You can't say, Adam loves me, this I know, you know. Adam doesn't know you from Adam. Which is a line I'm going to use. And the you know, the Jesus of Bishop Spahn, you know, what I'm going to point out that there is you in San Francisco?
Yeah.
There's an Episcopal church, maybe it's in fact the one that you go to, I don't know, but I'm going to be mentioning it, where they have this mural all around the wall of the various saints.
St. Gregory of Nyssa.
Is that where it is? And so they have Malcolm X and Gandhi and
Elizabeth I,
you know, all these saints of the church.
Can I just add that when they closed down the saints.
I'm going to say this.
Okay.
And so they had room for one more saint. And well, I mean, this is what I read in Christian Century,
right?
And which is liberal, you know, basically. And they had room for one more saint, and horror of horrors, both Mother Teresa and Princess Di died pretty much at the same time. So who to put up there? And they had, as I understand it, from reading the account written by the rector of the church in the Christian Century, they had a big controversy over it.
I'm not sure. And do you know Kelly Combs was this
panel? Was he there?
He was gone by that
time. Oh. So anyway, I mean, you know, there are some great Episcopal churches and great, I mean, there's a wonderful woman in a very important Episcopal church. She's very supportive of us, and I've been trying to get her as a keynoter for a number of years down at the Episcopal Church in Beverly Hills. Excellent preacher. And, you know, and many, many others. But then there are others where, you know, there's it's not Christianity.
How do you explain the popularity of Bishop Spahn and Marcus Borg and those people? I mean,
they say what a lot of people already believe. But the popularity with those people is the same as, you know, how do you explain the popularity of Jerry Falwell? He says what a lot of people believe. As a matter of fact, I think one of the problems is people simply go to hear the people they agree with. And now when people come here, you know, maybe they're caught blindsided and they don't know what I'm going to say, they're not going to like it, and then a lot of them don't come back. But if you've picked a church, you tend to go to the church where, you know, you're not going to have anything, any, you know, your boat rocked. So the left-wing people go to the left-wing churches, and the right-wing people go to the right-wing churches, and they all sit there, self-congratulatory, and nobody gets moved. See? That's the problem.
Well, it's easier not to think.
What's that?
It's easier.
Oh, it's easier not to think, and you know what's easier even than not to think? It's not to act. See?
Yeah.
Anyway, somebody else. Yes, sir.
What I found most refreshing today in the lecture was the fact that we too often are satisfied with just reconciling our homosexuality with our Christianity. And now we're comfortable. And we have gotten that third step.
Yeah.
And for myself, I need to hear it on a regular basis. I need the reminder.
Yes.
Because it's too easy to fall back on that.
Oh, in fact, there are a lot of people, I think, that as soon as they sort of get the idea that they're not going to hell for being gay, then they never come back. As though, had they never been gay, there was no place to go with growing in the Lord. See? And so as soon as they find out, oh, you know, I'm not going to roast in hell, then they just go out there and they don't lead their lives any differently from their non-Christian gay friends. And it's very easy to do that. And unless they stay in touch with some other people who are like-minded and like-committed, it's very easy to slip into, not only because you want to be affirmed by your friends and so forth, and you don't want to be out of step, but you also are not being nourished. So, you know, I mean, it's like the idea that Jesus said, to those who have, more will be given. To those who commit themselves to learning and acting on what they know, they will have more. And this is not a threat. This is, some sort of a crazy notion. The more you open yourself up to receiving, the more you will receive. If you close yourself down and say, I'm not going to, have anything more to do with the church or something like that, well, there's nothing coming in. So, you know, it's in that sort of poorly understood second law of thermodynamics illustration, it just deteriorates.
Up until about 4 years ago, I was a part of a church where everything that was taught in scripture had to get back to the gay thing. And I guess that's what I'm saying. And now I'm a part of a group where when we open the scriptures, okay, how does this impact my life? In what way is Jesus saying, follow me in this?
Yes.
But still, it's so easy.
For over two decades, our Bible study on Friday nights in New York City, we don't sit there and rehash the clobber passages. My goodness, you could become brain dead doing that. We just go through as much of a particular book as we can get done in an hour and a half, and then next week we pick up where we left off and do that. I mean, a couple of people here are from our group. And so we've been through every book of the Bible, I think, at least once, except I don't think we've ever actually done Numbers. Or Second Kings. But there's a lot of good stuff in them. Yes, sir.
I know you were very knowledgeable about church history, so my question is, the church on both the left and right seems very political today. On the right, they want legislation of abortion and homosexuality.
Yeah.
On the left, they want more social services, no Iraq war, and get rid of gun laws.
Right.
Has it always been like this? I know in the 19th century, there was slavery as an issue, but besides that, were there other things?
Or
is this new?
Well, no, I don't think it's all that new. I mean, since the, basically the 18th, 19th, and 20th century, there have always been these kinds of things, mainly because communication has been better and there's
democracy, you know, all that kind of thing. I mean, in many, many centuries past, about the only thing that people could do is make sure that they had enough to eat that day, you know, that sort of thing. So they didn't have the luxury of sitting around debating, you know, some of these things, and they didn't have democracy to do that. So, but it is certainly true that always throughout the history of the church, at least those who were the thinkers in the church, wrestled with whatever was the social issue or the scientific issue or, you know, whatever of the day, and bringing to bear as seriously and intelligently as they would what they understood the scripture, the revelation to point to. And you know, one of the things, and I would certainly put a plug in here for all of you to attend in September 26, 27, 28, those of you who were here last year and heard Roy Clemens preach, you know what a great expository preacher he is. Who here was here last year and heard him? Yes. He really is the finest expository preacher I've ever heard in my life, and had the most vibrant church in Cambridge, England for about 25 years, PhD in physics of all things. But he's going to be preaching four sermons in Ocean Grove, New Jersey. We're having the weekend conference and celebrating the 300th birthdays of both John Wesley and Jonathan Edwards. Now, in their day, John Wesley and Jonathan Edwards, you know, I mean, there would not be an American evangelical movement without Jonathan Edwards and John Wesley, because they brought together the Puritan and the Pietist streams, and out of that came the Great Awakening, and that really is what we know not as evangelical land today, but the evangelical fervor of American Christianity. And they were both out of their evangelical faith, committed to, you know, the abolition of slavery, more in Wesley's case than in Edwards, because it was more a deal in his circles, but with Edwards, the rights of the Native Americans in Stockbridge, as over against the French and the British mistreatment of them, and Wesley, you know, came afoul of many of his followers when he supported a man accused of sodomy and was thrown into jail in Oxford. In his commentary on 1 Corinthians 6:9, Wesley, in talking about the Molokoi, you know, the soft ones, he said, how come these people are thought to be, you know, sodomites? And he said, you know, and he went on to say sodomites were, you know, people who were bowing down to idols in the Old Testament. I mean, Wesley knew what it was about. Falwell doesn't, you know. So these great evangelical leaders, you know, were, you know, speaking out about the, you know, about the mistreatment of people in their day, and the same way D.L. Moody did in his day. And the thing that we see right now with the religious right is a very new phenomenon. And sadly, you know, it's a very loud phenomenon. But along with it, there is also plenty within the large evangelical framework that has nothing to do with religious right. And I think it, you know, mustn't lose heart that there are plenty of people who are just as concerned as you are about the good treatment of gay people and others, and but don't compromise on the basic sound evangelical faith.
Do you think there could be a split in evangelicalism over the issue of gay or the gay issue?
Well, evangelicalism isn't united about anything, so there can't be a split.
I mean, could there be a sort of a, you know, there's evangelicalism and then there's liberalism and Catholicism, maybe?
Well, there already is, you know, there already is this division. There are even books written about the, you know, the evangelical left and the evangelical right and, you know, those sorts of things. Millard Erickson at Bethel, who was president of the National Association of Evangelicals, of which I'm a member, a longtime member, National Association of Evangelicals, my place, you know. Evangelical Theological Society. I'm a member of that. You know, they've never kicked me out. And that is a very conservative group. Not so much religious right as just very theologically conservative institution. And so it's already divvied up, you know. There was, I was at the Evangelical Theological Society meetings up in Toronto in November, and they're trying to get rid of one of the members, who was Clark Pinnock, who maybe some of you know about, because of his open theist position, which I think in one sense is not as big a deal as either people who are pro or anti open theism position made out, but anyway, there are some very fundamentalist mentality people in the ETS who won't sleep until they, you know, get rid of every ounce of anything to the left of them, and so they've brought him up on charges, and so it was a big meeting of the membership late at night after the meetings all day, and they voted and so forth. But they were voting on whether to keep him in, or people would line up the pro over here and the con over here at the microphone, and it was surprising. There were only this little tiny cadre of about eight or ten. People in the membership, all of whom were in the departments of systematic theology, as over against biblical theology and New Testament scholarship and all these things, because that's the way they think, narrow systematics. But over in this aisle, long, long aisle, could hardly get everybody in, and they were trying to do one here, one there, one there, but nobody. So people kept revolving over here on this one, and on the kick them out line. And of course, over here on this line also were, some of the student members. When you're young, it's pretty much more black and white. But it's an old-time, staunch evangelical biblical scholars and so forth over in this line. And some of them, it was amazing what schools they were with. And their colleagues were there, and they were taking risks in some sense, supporting Clark. And one from Dallas Seminary, it's very evangelical, theological seminary. And one of my alma maters too. And this guy, he finally said, if this vote goes through, he said, I've had it with this organization. It was that kind of anger and so forth. And then there was another professor from Dallas that I noticed quoted in, he had an op-ed piece in the New York Times a few months ago in which he said some fairly, sort of supportive things about treating gay people better within the context of what, I forget the main point of the op-ed piece. And so I looked him up on the thing, and I sent him an email thanking him for it. And he didn't even know that it had already been in there or quoted or something. And so he wrote back a nice thing. But in the meantime, in order to find him, I put his name in, and some things came up that he had written about homosexuality more negatively about 10 years ago. So I mentioned, what he sees about and so forth, and I said I had noticed that he'd written this thing. And he wrote back and he said, well, that's not really where I am today, you know, that sort of a thing. And he didn't try to dissuade me from my point of view, and he said, you know, wished me, you know, not to say luck, but, you know, I mean, wished me well, and was interested in hearing more about what I was saying. So you know, you do have that. And you don't have, on the left or in the liberal church, you don't have openness to a point of view that is not popular in that circle. At evangelical seminaries, they study liberal theologians. At liberal seminaries, they do not study evangelical
theologians.
So who is the closed-minded?
And who is the inclusive?
And who is inclusive, exactly.
I would be curious for you to sort of place some of the gay organizations theologically, by how conservative they are, not common ex-gay ones. Do you see sort of the most conservative of the gay Christian groups? Or are there people to the right?
You know, there are a few, I would say even fundamentalist gay groups that meet, you know, like a little local church of, you know, not too many people and so forth. And in some sense, you know, they would seem to be more conservative theologically than I am, or, you know, whatever. But it's not that so much. It's just, you know, they're not trained, and so they, you know, they just, you know, it's sort of a literalistic way of dealing with the Bible and so forth. So far as a major kind of organization, you know, that would have, you know, a couple hundred people at a conference, I don't know of anything. I mean, there really is just, there's EC, and then there are a few local groups of things that might be Pentecostal or, you know, and then there's the caucus is associated with mainline denominations, and their main thrust is basically to get the denomination to change its policies on ordination or something like that, and so forth. Though Mel is evangelical, Soul Force is certainly not an evangelical organization. So that's why I say, this is the only game in town, really. MCC is a crapshoot, you know. I mean, this particular local congregation can be, you know, one thing, and this, you know, because it grew like Topsy, and they just, you know. So there's some, you know, I know a woman who came to one of our conferences out east, and she said she volunteered to sing at one of the MCC churches, and she was going to sing a song about Jesus. They said, oh, no, we don't want songs about Jesus. That would be offensive to some people. So, I mean, you have that, and then you have some other people who are just very, it's a, sort of a wide. Is it time to end? Anybody tired?
2:30.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. I noticed that there seemed to be more mention of EC and even of yourself in some of the newer books coming out about homosexuality. Like there's a little
in what book?
Bad book. Well, there's Facts on Homosexuality. Mm-hmm. It's a little book, this whole series of books by Ankerberg. And he does, I mean, and he seems to do a fairly good job at describing.
Ankerberg, he mentioned me?
Yeah.
Really?
There's a new book out, and I was surprised at the section on EC.
Oh, really, isn't there?
Yeah.
Well, let me know what that is. What I found is a lot of times, you know, and even though we have some people, as I was saying, at CT that are, you know, friendly, I've noticed that over the years, and this shows how seriously they take EC. You never see anything in CT about EC. You'll see it about Soul Force, you'll see it about MCC, you'll see it about the gay caucuses in the Presbyterian Church and so forth. You'll never see anything about EC.
Well, they have nothing to benefit from.
Exactly. They don't want to send anybody to us, and they know if they say something about these other things, the readership, you know, of course, you know, what do you expect? These crazy people, you know. But, you know, they cannot deny that ours is an evangelical organization, or that my theology is evangelical, or you know, whatever. And so they just don't touch it. World Magazine, who knows World Magazine? You know, I get that. And in fact, the Record and Review, the review that's coming out this coming week, is an attack on three articles in World Magazine. And over the years, you know, I've written reviews on stuff from World and made mention of them, and I've even written to the editor, or the publisher now, and never do they mention us, or, you know, even in a negative piece, you know, never. It's as though we don't exist. And I've heard
it. That's the way it was in 1950. We don't exist.
Yes, right. I mean, gay people exist, but not seriously evangelical gay people exist. And as I was pointing out, we don't exist also for the lesbigate movement in general, you know. And, yes.
I was talking to Brent about the situation in the church over there, and we were wondering, I was wondering, she thought that maybe the Queen of England had intervened on that situation with the gay bishop, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, Jeremy John?
Yeah. Do you think that was a possibility?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that the Queen is that interested in these things. But I, you know, I have no idea, you know, how that happened.
I thought it was interesting. The church interferes a lot with politics. I was wondering if you see the political ground interfering a lot with politics or vice versa in any kind of situations.
Well, I mean, you're asking specifically about the Queen, though she's the titular head of the church. Right. She's
not really.
She's the Queen.
Yeah.
I don't think that they're too much interested in theology.
You said that that the people in evangelicalism is like more for us than there's against us.
No, I didn't say more for us than against us. There are more that are in our corner and supportive and so forth than you may realize.
Oh,
so.
Okay, because it seems to me like that would be something that the media would want to jump on, because it's like, you know, it's like totally antithesis of the big shots, what they say. I mean, and it's that.
Well, but to see, you absolutely, really, you know, and you may disagree with me, but I do think that a liberal agenda controls the media. And so they don't want to make the evangelical world look large-hearted. For example, I wonder how many here heard from the media that recently, when George W. Bush invited his law school, or not law school, he got his degree in business at Yale, the Yale alumni, you know, group, that he invited to the White House, the whole class. And this was a few months ago. And one of the individuals who was there had a sex change operation between the time that he, now she, knew George W. at Yale. And this person, his first name was Peter. Was Peter. So he walked up to President Bush, shook his hand, but now as a woman, and said, you probably remember me as Peter. And George W. Bush said to him, or her now, and now you've come as yourself. Shook his hand. Shook her hand. Wow. Now, that shows, you know, George W. Bush is not on the same page with Falwell and Robinson. Did you see that in the paper?
No.
No. I saw only one. It was picked up by only one newspaper, so far as I know, the San Francisco Chronicle, of all papers. And then Michelangelo Signorelli took note of it in his column in the New York Press. But you didn't see that, because that makes George W. Bush look like a good guy in the eyes of the liberal establishment. So you don't do that. So, you know, you can be an evangelical and say some nice things about gay people and you'll never get out, and at least in the secular press. It'll get out in World Magazine. But, I mean, one of the things that I'm critiquing is a pleasant word for it, in the next review from World, at one point, Bells, who is the publisher, addresses through his column George W. Bush and says, Mr. President, don't you dare give in on this homosexual marriage, you know, issue. Because if you do, 3 to 10 million voters will desert you immediately. So, you know, it's that kind of a mentality. Now, the same man, Joel Bells, and in my review, I'm reviewing another thing in the issue prior to that, in his page, publisher's page. He wrote a thing that he headlined the Pride Game. It had nothing to do with gay pride. The Pride Game. And he said that he was, he said that Christians can be very insensitive to where, you know, minority people are and so forth. But he said, we Christians are now in the minority, and so we must learn from these other minorities like blacks and Jews. He didn't mention in this context gays. He said that he was standing waiting for a bus at an airport recently with some friends. You can just imagine the kinds of friends probably he was in. And just to pass the time, he mentioned that his last name was originally a Jewish name in Europe, Bells, B-E-L-Z. And of course he's not Jewish. So he just mentioned that as they're standing there waiting for the bus to the airport. And one of the guys says, and you're bragging about that? Which is, of course, you know, very politically incorrect insensitivity. But that's the way a lot of people talk. So he said that somebody else in their crowd quickly changed the subject because he recognized it was a very uncomfortable kind of thing to have said. And he said that's illustrative of what he's talking about, that we play this pride game, that, you know, that we're better than the others and so forth. And he said that now finally that evangelical Christians are in the minority, you know, in some sense, at least vis-a-vis the secular press, that we should be sensitive to that and learn from others, and so we should listen to how have they coped, you know, the Jews and the blacks in being victims of the pride game. And he said, and of course we're very capable of playing the pride game ourselves. So he was calling for some humility, and you know. So of course I put that into, you know, his lashing out at gays in the next issue. You know, but it's an interesting combination of, you know, words, they get it about some things, but they don't get it about other things. One of the other articles that I factored into this review was by the editor of, who's Marvin Alasky, I think, who basically came up with the idea, with the term, compassionate conservative. And he teaches journalism at the University of Texas. And he's Jewish Christian. And he recently did a survey of long-term married people. They've been married 50 years, 60 years. And how wonderful it has been for them, and how much, you know, how could they have lived without it, and you know, that sort of thing. And he celebrated it and so on. And yet, at the end of reporting on these various people, you know, telling them this and that, and, you know, and this was written before the Lawrence decision, is in, and imagine now, you know, you're being assaulted by the possibility that the Supreme Court is going to even give gay marriage to homosexuals. He said, well, you know, whatever happened to the Golden Rule? If this is so precious to them, why don't they want it, you know, for others? You see? It's very inconsistent. No Golden Rule. Doesn't say do unto only those who behave as you think they should or something. Do unto others as you may have them do unto you. So then, you know, but there's...
I was going to say, it's actually very inconsistent of the church, well, the homophobic viewpoint, to argue on the one hand that they don't like homosexual behavior, and on the other hand, to insist that it's not possible to have, that there isn't a sanctioning of long-term relationships on a substantive basis. You know, if that's, if you drive it underground, don't be surprised when it behaves as if it's underground.
Well, exactly. I mean, exactly. Look at the very pathetic statistics on single parent households and so forth among African Americans in this country, and that has to be somewhat related to the disallowal of marriage for, you know, slaves and, you know, and that sort of thing. So it's not, you know, it's not strange that there's the kind of statistics that we have. And if you haven't picked up my lecture at Princeton that is down on the resource table, pick one up. It's only $1. It's a lecture I gave earlier this year at Princeton, and in which I point out that when you really start to pare it down, their argument against homosexuality, from what they say themselves, what it boils down is the juxtaposing of the nerve endings of the symmetrical genitalia. That's what it's about. Because even the anti-gay evangelicals, I mean, many of them, will permit two people of the same gender to live together, who are in love with each other and so forth, and so, yes, help each other out and, you know, cook for each other and, you know, so on. And hug, because everybody needs a hug. And so, and you can kiss on the cheek or something, or maybe a peck on the lips or something, because people do that. But you cannot touch a certain, you know, square inch of epidermal surface, or more than a square inch in some people's case, but you cannot touch that. That is the thing that will send you to hell. I mean, it is ludicrous.
I've seen in some magazine they call that the ick factor.
The ick factor.
The ick.
The ick.
Some people they don't have a rational.
Some people pronounce EC.
Yeah. But this is the ICK. Ick.
So, I mean, you know, when you really press it, that's what it's about. I mean, even some of the ex-gay movement things. They see nothing wrong with, yes, you know, okay, you're homosexual, and, you know, and so, you know, you can live with each other, but you just mustn't have sex. So then, you know, my response to that is like with Jeffrey Johns, who says that now after 27 years, he and his partner don't have sex. Well, I said, well, unfortunately, many people who've been together for 27 years don't have sex anymore. So, because all kinds of pathology, really, incest, taboo, and all. But so, I mean, if Jerry Falwell and these other people really don't want people to behave genitally with same-sex partners,
let them get married and wait a while, and they will indeed be celibate. It takes a while for some people to get it there. Anyway, yes, sir.
I was just thinking of the golden rule. And if they were in the room, they would say, well, why I am doing it to you is as I want to do to me, because you could also marry a woman. And if you don't want to do it, you're broken. That's why the ex-gay was...
Say this again, then.
Well, they would say they are following the golden rule, because if you're a man who's gay, they would say, well, I would have you also have a woman like I do. So that they do want that best for that other person.
Yes, but that is not doing unto others, because, you see, with them, they insist, I am the one who picks who is my partner. In your case, I am the one who gets to pick who is your partner. You see, so that's not doing unto others. That's doing against them.
Well, what they're thinking is there's something broken in you that needs to be fixed, and then you will want one. And that's not being compassionate. And I just think that the ex-gays are a necessary piece of the puzzle for the right to think they are following the golden rule, and that's the weak point. And it's getting worse every year.
Yeah, and I think too that an awful lot of people who support the ex-gay movement, that is among preachers, I mean, some of them are genuinely ignorant, but many of them, I think, after all this time, have to see that it's not working. But they politically and economically cannot do otherwise. Economically, it would be disaster. Where are they going? You know, their credentials are in the GAOD or, you know, the PCA or whatever. And where are they going to get a job? And their otherwise theology is too conservative for, you know, Presbyterian Church USA, or something, you know, they wouldn't feel comfortable there anyway, and how are they going to put their kids through college, you know, without a job, you know, so, I mean, you have to feel for the hard choices that they make, plus, unlike us, it's not a daily, you know, on the radar screen, you know, just, you know, they have their plate loaded with other things, and so it's, you know, I try and point out to people who say, okay, we've had a session on, you know, the Bible, the Cobra passages, or the, you know, how we must let gay people have their relationship. But now we have to move on. We have other things on the agenda and so forth. I say, wait, the gay people, they're now going to lunch with the same orientation and the same needs and the same desires. And then this afternoon, it's going to be the same for them. And you've gone on to some other subject and gone home to your wife, and then this evening they're still left with the same desires. You know, what are they going to do with these things? And 5 years on, they still have it daily. You know, so what practical solution do you have for them? And I saw that again in World Magazine, this latest issue, get had Andre Sue. She was writing to apparently a gay man who wrote her and said she was being cruel in the way in which she was talking about gay people. And she has been very snippy. And so she wrote that, and says, dear, you know, his first name, thank you for writing. You're right. You know, you've really turned my world upside down. You know, I realize that I have not been nice about these things, and so you know, and what brought me around was a wonderful man by the name of, and that's his name, who happens also to be homosexual, you know, so she goes on and on, you know, but then at the end, you know, she says, but nonetheless, you know, you're wrong, and you're going to hell if you don't change your mind, and, you know, and that sort of thing. But then at one point she says, and I'm so glad that I can say to you, as a word of encouragement, that I am a widow, and that it's not just the gay men who are lonely and want companionship and so forth. There are widows, as myself, who don't have a partner, you know, and they think that this is a parallel.
I mean, she could go out on Tuesday and find a husband.
That's right.
And everybody in her circle would rejoice.
Yeah.
But this poor Elliot, or whatever she gave him as a name, he can't do that. I spoke of at Gordon College, which, by the way, you know, is another indication. You know, Gordon College invited me to come up and speak. You know, I've spoken at various Christian colleges already. And one of the Bible professors, a woman. I forget what she taught. Anyway, she was a faculty member, and she said, "I'm single, and you know, and so I have to be celibate too. You know, so I'm not asking gay people to do anything other than what I do." I said, "Well, no, wait a minute." I said, "You are single and have been single, and might continue to be single, but you could go out and date, and everybody on the campus would be glad for you, and you could have a, you know, a marriage, and everybody would come to the wedding and to cheer you on." I said, "Is that an option for gay people from your point of view?" And so she just sat there and didn't say anything. Next question. I mean, see, they haven't thought this stuff through.
Like,
they're not so much, you know, homo-hateful as just oblivious, you see? Have you seen that TV show, Oblivious? No?
No, I'm oblivious.
It's oblivious. You're oblivious. Anyway, what?
Well, I mean, you're talking about well-educated people.
Yeah.
So,
well, sometimes they're the toughest, because the less educated just sort of know what life's about.
Well, I understand. I'm sure that's correct. But I guess what I'm saying, I guess the question I'm trying to get at is, there's a cultural resistance that abides in some fashion that really does throw a veil over our ability to think about the subject.
Our ability to
think about the subject. And if
it's the ick factor.
It's the ick factor, yeah. And I think that's probably right. It's the ick factor. But, you know, I it's difficult to understand why it isn't a subject that can't be treated seriously and thought through seriously. I mean, it's difficult for me to understand how theologians how it's an unexamined area of Scripture, an unthought-out area of Scripture.
Well, you see, I think that when we're dealing with a lot of issues, including homosexuality, but a lot of issues,
yes,
we're not really dealing so much intellectually with things. We're dealing with pathology in the minds and lives of individuals who speak about these things. And, you know, don't forget, when you think about it, most parents who discover that their kid is gay, they don't discover it in the second year of their marriage. They discover it in about the 15th or 16th year of the marriage, when their own sex life has been going through a lot of trouble, in statistically most cases, where maybe even the husband has maybe fooled around, and she is aware of it and angry at him, and he is aware, she knows, and is feeling guilty about it and defensive about it and so on. And they have not been having sex for 3 or 4 years. And, you know, all kinds of stuff is going on in their lives. And then comes along their kid having sex, or, you know, thinking about it. So there's that going on. And many of these are preachers, or other people in the pews, you know, who hear about gays and
they're out having all kinds of sex, and here my wife, you know, has a headache every night, you know, and I don't get any, and they get to go out and have sex with different people all the time, you know. These are practical things that are going on in the minds, even if they have theology degrees, or if they're doctors, or lawyers, or whatever in the pews. This is going on. And some of them are closet cases. I mean, there's just all kinds of messes out there.
So it wasn't just the one.
No, and so when they then frame it as, well, the Bible says, that's hogwash. And so we have to understand it's a lot more complicated than simply winning them over to our exegesis.
Another little passage. How do you answer when they say that if you allow gay marriage, then what's next? Brothers and sisters?
And bestiality and so on. See, that kind of an idea is, again, a smokescreen. Because they know darn well, where is the hue and cry that I be allowed to marry my cat? You know, no. I mean, you cannot find, maybe in the News of the World or something, you might find something about that. But nobody is calling for that. You know, see?
So it's a, take the one oddball in
well, they haven't even found that. They haven't been found that oddball yet.
Theoretically, yeah.
But that you have to take into consideration too. That and so they bring up these silly things, you know. I mean, and then they say, well, you know, how about, you know, not just then a man, two men or two women, but how about a man and two women, or, you know, whatever. And that, again, relatively few are calling for. You know, maybe some hillbillies out in Utah, you see, sort of so-called fundy Mormons. But in a society where adults expect parity and equality, threesomes, or what, you know, they now in certain chic circles, I noticed that one of the speakers at the recent Columbus, Ohio gay and religion conference was pushing a former Lutheran, now Wicca, and she says that, well, she now has a relationship with a man and a woman because she's a bisexual, and so they have a polyamorous relationship, and you know, you've probably heard that word, they're pushing polyamory, you know. Well, again, it's so naive, because the expectations are for parity. And as soon as you have a polyamorous relationship, you have a recipe for jealousy. Now, if even in a culture that expected the man to be the king of the hill and have his concubines and so forth, did Hagar and Sarah get along? No. See? So how do you expect Western educated adults to find it easy to deal with, oh yes, you know, you have, tonight you're with him or her. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So that's a non-starter. But it makes a good, you know, emotional argument against gay marriage. What?
They do have a little bit of an argument in that our courts are clogged up with the oddball cases. Maybe not clogged up, but they sure make headlines.
Well, don't forget, a lot of the things that make headlines that are oddball are, in terms of courts, for example, they're thrown out. As soon as they get in front of the judge, the whole thing is thrown out. And yet, in the paper, you read, you know, man sues, you know, something, you know, for, you know, the dumbest of reasons and sues for millions of dollars. Well, that never gets to first base. So,
but the headlines make it a popular argument.
Well, yeah, but popular is usually
empathetic. What?
I have a quick question. I'm wondering how long until success, where you could define that as the majority of evangelicals share our views on homosexuality. 1 year seems like way too short. 1,000 years, too long. What approximate number of years strikes you as about right for that?
162.
Well, I think when you look at the cultural conservatives in this country, a lot of which are in evangelical land, where were they on issues of segregation and integration? They basically brought up the rear, and I think on this one they'll bring up the rear. You couldn't go to a mega church today and say we mustn't have any blacks in this congregation or anything like that, you know. And yet, 40 years ago,
20
years ago, it was possible. So I would say certainly, and you see, one of the advantages that gay people have that blacks did not is that nobody discovered a black person in their family. White family is, my goodness, he's black, you know.
Everyone's openly black.
Huh?
What? Everyone's openly black.
Well, yes, I mean, the black people grew up in their family, and the white people, you know, and so on. But with the gay thing, the gay people that people are more and more likely to know are not the other, over on the other side of town or whatever, but they are their own sons and daughters and nephews and nieces and so forth. So the more that happens, the more people have a vested interest to come to terms with it. And in all my years of doing therapy, and you hear horrible stories about people kicking out their kids and stuff when they found that they're gay. I have never seen anybody who kicked out a kid and kept the kid out. The worst case of that I ever had was with a client who he was working for his parents' company, and so they found out he was gay. He was in his late 20s, and they fired him, took away his insurance, and so on, and so on. But by the next I think it was Rosh Hashanah, he was back with them, having dinner, celebrating the High Holy Days, and so forth. So it was about a year. Because people cannot forever, you know, they might make a big stink at first to try to convince the person not to, you know, go this bad way, but eventually they come around. Even if it's only, you know, we never talk about it, but, you know, we come.
So do you want to go on record with a prediction of the number of years?
What's that?
Do you want to go on record with a prediction of the number of years?
The number of years.
John Poindexter's trying to organize a poll. On this subject.
Yes, wasn't that a horrible
interview on it?
Wasn't that a horrible
interview? That's very funny.
Well, I'll tell you, I was surprised the other night, you know, when Bob Hope died, I forget what program it was, but they had a split screen with Pat Boone on one side and some editor of Parade magazine on the other. And they were talking about how Bob Hope's, you know, humor was clean and so. Anyway, the guy from Parade, of course, was all for, letting it all hang out. And so the interviewer, I forget which program it was, but anyway, he asked the guy from Parade, how many years would it be before we have actual, real, not simulated, real sex on TV? And he said, probably about 2 years. So I wouldn't have thought that would be possible, but here's a commentator on the cultural scene, you know, saying this. But I would say that with more and more people finding out that they have gay people in their families and so forth, that it'll be more and more a non-issue. The only reason that it's an issue in certain political circles that are intersecting with evangelical land is that it is a political hot issue, and it's a way to raise funds and, you know, and that sort of thing. But you see, you have your fifth column in every mega church, and the fifth column is not so much the gay people, but the parents and brothers and sisters of gay people. And so after a while, there's just going to be I hate to use this term, but a tipping point, and it'll be passé to make a big deal out of it. There was a point where interracial marriage was a big deal in the churches, you know. There was a time when women preachers were a big deal in churches. By the way, you know that evangelical churches were the first to have women preachers. Did you know that?
No. Where? Pentecostal?
Pentecostal churches. And I mean, there were a lot of things that were progressive that came first from the evangelical churches. Birth control, for example, was an issue against which the churches of the National Council of Churches railed at one time in the 40s. So, I mean, just, you know, birth control. So,
yeah. Plus, I'm a high school teacher, and I see the attitudes of the kids are changing, too. I mean,
exactly. And they couldn't care less.
It's a non-issue with them.
A non-issue, exactly. I think that's a big way it'll be. It'll just be a non-issue, and it'll take, you still want the number of years, you know, say, you know, another 10 years, I think. Yeah. But, there's always going to be, you know, the opposition, just as there is today about race issues. But in general, it's going to be a ho-hum in 10 or 20 years. I mean, I would never have thought that we'd be, you know, where we are today when I started EC, or, you know. I mean, oh, for example, when I started my private practice of therapy back in '02, you know, well, it was just last year, I think. Back in '69, '70, I had what are called, and probably some of you maybe would remember this, but some of you, coming out groups. Did you ever hear about coming out groups? Mm-hmm. Nobody asks me for a coming out group these days. It's not an issue. They come out, and that, or they've never been in, you know, or whatever. See, but coming out groups for people in their 30s, 40s, and, you know, so. Well, that's a change. And who would have thought that I would be invited to speak at Gordon College or at Calvin College, where I address the, you know, in both cases, the whole assembly. And who would have thought we had keynoters from Fuller Seminary and Hope College and. I spoke at Hope College too. The whole, there's a Hope alumnus.
I didn't go.
But were you on the campus that day? You heard about me?
Of course, but I didn't think it had anything to do with me, so I didn't go.
Ah. But it did.
The same plan. It was like, it's in my ear. I almost never heard that word.
What, homosexual?
Gay.
Gay?
It didn't mean anything to me. It was foreign. Completely. But I was thinking about it.
And we even had the reception in the president's lounge, you know. And this was in 83, I think.
83.
What?
The kids nowadays being so accepting of someone, I don't know. To go along with that, there's such a pervasive, and as far as like
what we see on television and so forth, the casual sex going on, and all the irresponsibility,
right.
social irresponsibility,
right.
anything goes mentality.
Right.
It's like, oh, you got to be cool. That's okay. Just, you go out
right.
and you know, date and make people do all this irresponsibility and stuff.
And that is disordered, as I said this morning, and it leads to more disorder, and that's sad, you know.
But it seems to be, quote-unquote, the cool thing, the whole MTV generation. But those are the ones that are more open to...
By the way, do you know that statistical analysis indicates that kids in evangelical churches are as apt to watch MTV as kids in outside of evangelical churches? Did you know that? It's not promising. And did you know which section of the country leads in divorce? The Bible Belt. Of course, they get married, and people in the North and the East don't, but when I use that statistic, I usually, it depends on which. Audience, I don't mention. I mean, that's obviously what affects it. But, you know, in other words, there's plenty of chaos out there in those families. It's one of the reasons they're so scared, you know, about the future of their marriage.
Well, it's also one reason why we have to be worse, you know, because then it
makes
them look not so bad.
Right. Right. But you can imagine, if there's that kind of chaos in even evangelical families out there, heterosexual families, how many of are the dangers for us as we try to have an ongoing relationship? All the more reason we need marriage and the stability and so forth. And to get away from all this nonsense about polyamory and, you know, and so forth. I mean, and there's a great deal of movement within the lesbian gay community, for example, that is very hostile to the move for gay marriage. You know, we don't want to be saddled with, you know, straight structures and stuff like that. You see, as though it's a straight structure.
And the marriage tax penalty.
What about that?
And the marriage tax penalty.
Oh yes, right.
You're telling me. Here in California, a community property state.
Well, the time has gone, so thank you for your kind indulgence.
Thank you.